All right. So we're going to begin one of these days here, any minute. Okay. Now, it is a little bit noisy, but after a while we just forget it, and it just... Yeah, the rules of the road. Gosh, one should almost begin with that. It's a good reminder. Let's do that. Let's read one after another the rules of the road, which sets our sets the right attitude in all this work. Hope you can see well. Who would like to read the first one? Where you just have to look over here, Martha, on the on the screen. Rules of the road. Different glasses. Okay, well, we'll start and then you can do another one. I'll just start this. The road is trodden in the full light of day, thrown upon the path by those who know and lead. Naught can then be hidden, and at each turn upon that road, a man must face himself. Okay, next, Martha, you read the next one. Number two.
Upon the road, the hidden stands revealed. Each sees and knows the
villainy
of each. And yet there is, with that great revelation, no turning back, no spurning of each other, no shadiness upon the road. The road goes forward into day.
This is a rule that a lot of groups have to remember, because they fall into that criticism of each other, because they see each other, everyone sees everyone, and they say, oh, well, you're not what I expected. And so we start criticizing each other, and we start saying, you know, get out of my life, and I'm not certain if I should be doing this. That's called shakiness upon the road. And then say, well, I started this, but I don't think it's for me, and then I turn back. All these things really have to be remembered. Okay, Eric, you read the next one.
Upon that road, one wanders not alone. There is no rush, no hurry, and yet there is no time to lose. Each pilgrim, knowing this, presses his footsteps forward and finds himself surrounded by his fellow men. Some move ahead, he follows after. Some move behind, he sets the pace. He travels not alone.
So here's the basis of the whole group process and how we are, and we have to realize our place and who we can look towards for help and who we have to help. You know, this will appear also in the next rule about how you're always traveling with others. And if you want to get through the gates of initiation, it's never alone. It's always with others. Grasping the hand of your brother or sister, you can go through the gate. And if you try to go through yourself, it's too narrow. That's kind of interesting. You can go through 10 abreast and you can all get through, and alone it's too narrow. Who would like to read the next one?
I'll take the next one. Three things the pilgrim must avoid. The wearing of a hood, a veil.
Hides his face
from others, the carrying of a water pot, which only holds enough for his own wants, the shouldering of a staff without a crook to hold.
So we have three things here. We're not supposed to hide ourselves from our fellow pilgrims, you know. In other words, we veil ourselves because we don't want people to see what's going on in our inner life. And, you know, we're out in the desert and we have a canteen, but it's only enough and we don't have anything to share. And the last one is very interesting. This sort of gives you the symbology of the Pope or the Bishop. They have this staff, and it's not just a staff like a rod. At the top of it, it's got this, like the planet Ceres. See? That's called the shepherd's crook. So when the sheep are wandering away, you get them, you keep them from wandering off. When your flock is wandering off, you're able to find the way to pull them back to the into the group. And so he's saying that the first ray method, where you just say, I'm going on my way and that's it and I don't care about you, you have to have concern for your fellow pilgrims. So you will have the shepherd's crook. And of course, the Christ is called the Good Shepherd. He's got a very effective shepherd's crook. So again, we see we're not traveling alone. We see that. Okay, who would like to read the next one?
I can read it.
Okay.
Each pilgrim on the road must carry with him what he needs. A pot of fire to warm his fellow men. A lamp to cast his ray upon his heart and show his fellow men the nature of his hidden life. A purse of gold, which he scatters not upon the road, but shares with others. A sealed vase.
Sealed.
Sealed, yeah, vase. Wherein he carries all his aspiration to cast before the feet of him who waits to greet him on the gate. A sealed vase.
Yeah, he repeats it. A sealed vase. It's so interesting. You know, I've memorized these rules of the road because I think they are so very important. I remember when we started a class somewhere long ago. It was supposed to be a high-level class, and I began it with, let's study the rules of the road. I said, oh, we know those. And we're here to study occultism and deep esoteric things. Why are we bothering with this old simple symbolism, the rules of the road? And then over the years, the group went forward and proceeded to break every one of the rules of the road. That's just how it is, you know. So in this ancient language, advice, deep advice to those who are treading the path of spiritual occultism is given. It's always the simple things that we don't, we say, we are the learned aspirants and esotericists. We know that stuff already. But you can know it with your mind, and you don't really know it with your heart. It's not part of you. That's why these things are so important. Well, a pot of fire to warm his fellow men. Well, we're told in the very first rule for initiation, let the disciples search within the heart's deep cave. If there the fire burns bright, warming his fellow men, yet heating not himself, the hour has come for making application to stand before the door. Warmth. This is solar fire. We're talking about solar fire here. We're not talking about fire by friction, right? So in other words, as you know, the path can be cold and lonely, and if you are treading the path, the idea is you have to have those words, those thoughts, those actions which animate your fellow traveler and give them the feeling of attractive warmth. It's very necessary for the group cohesion. Okay, and then this other thing, it's a lamp to show your heart and show your fellow travelers or fellow men the nature of your hidden life. So what's good about that? You see, have you ever been inspired by learning about the life of someone who has struggled and who has achieved?
Absolutely.
So, you know what I mean? It's the name of the game, isn't it? When we learn about the people who have gone ahead of us on the path and what their struggles have been, and they have been willing to share that instead of wearing a veil that covers their face, then we gain by that, do we not? So we have to be willing to share our process. Right. Sharing our process.
Not too much.
Not, we don't want to share on an astrological square. We want to share on a triangle. Yeah, that's okay. So, and that doesn't mean, you know, we have this thing in psychology called self-disclosure, where people are, you know, sort of like confessing and admitting to things all the time. You don't want to overdo it. But where things are appropriate, you know, where you can say, look, I can relate to that. Once in my life, thus and so happened, and this is what I learned, etc. It's very valuable. Yeah? Then this is interesting. A purse of gold, whatever is of value, is saying don't waste your energy, right? Don't waste your money. Don't waste what can create, but share it appropriately. So, this is like obvious, but you know, we need to suppose our society, which is presently falling apart, were to live more by these rules. This would be a very different situation than what we have. And this last one is very interesting. A sealed vase. Well, you know, if the vase is not sealed, it's running all over. You know, if you tilt it, it pours. But if you seal it, then even if you turn it upside down, nothing comes out of it. So this is aspiration that you are sealing inside that vase. What is it? Why is that a valuable process? Why to do that? If you see,
it keeps the essence of yourself, and it doesn't, you know, it remains intact. It is in a seal.
It's a
container.
When it's sealed, it doesn't escape, and it gives you more power. You know, because, you know, like I say, look, I'm not interested in your aspiration. I'm interested in what your aspiration makes you do. In other words, what are your actions based on your aspiration? So a lot of people say, oh, I want this and I want that and I aspire to this, but they don't do anything. But if they keep the aspiration in a contained, powerful condition, then it will work to help them manifest that aspiration in the world. So there is something called the glamour of aspiration. Have you heard of it? It's one of the, and there is a, let's see, I'm trying to think about the four veils of illusion, four veils on the etheric plane. I think it's one's called the veil of impulsion, it's like Maya, the veil of, let me just quick. It's like I'll find it here. Veil of impulsion. Yeah, and then the veil of distortion. That's the glamour one. The veil of distortion, and then each one of these is connected with one of the planes. Then the veil of separation, which is obvious mentality. It's all about the separative mind, and the last one is the veil of aspiration, where you're all caught up in wishing you were something, trying to be something, instead of just being that something. You know, so it's almost like aspiration becomes a distraction. So, you know, don't waste your time telling other people about how you're aspiring. Show the effects of your aspiration in service. That's what this is saying. And who's here? Someone is waiting to greet you at the gate. Who is that? Okay, wait a second. My computer has all these funny little... There it is. Okay, so you're going to hold, as far as your fellow human beings and disciples are concerned, you're going to hold the power of your aspiration in the vase of your energy system. But when you enter through the gate, then you pour it forth to your soul, to the master, to whomever, because that's who it was really intended for anyway. So it's a very interesting thing about how we talk to each other, how we encourage each other, how we refer to ourselves. I'm an aspirant. I hear a lot of people say that. I aspire. They don't do anything with it. So we keep that controlled. Okay. And the last one is very interesting too, because it has seven things that you need as you walk upon that road. Who would like to read this last one? Okay.
The pilgrim, as he walked upon the road, must have the open ear, the open ear, the given hand, the silent tongue.
Chastened.
The golden voice, the rabbit foot, and the open eye, which sees the light. He knows his travel is not alone.
Yeah, and this last one, in a way, you know, it's like... He knows he travels not alone. The first one, he travels not alone, and by this time he really knows it, you see. So obviously we have to be able to listen. You know, we have two ears and one mouth, as they say. So we listen. We share, giving hand. We know when to be quiet, when not to criticize, when not to discuss our fellow disciples to their disadvantage. You know, we all do that. The chastened heart. Disciplined. The disciplined heart. Through bitter experience, you learn what to desire and what not to desire. Because if you're, you know, there's many desires in the heart, so to speak, and they can go in all the wrong direction, so you learn, because of pain and bitter experience, what it is right to desire and what pursue. What I want to do here for a second is I want to look up the word chastened, because it's one of those older English words. We don't speak so much about chastened anymore. Whoa. You have been wounded,
yeah.
and now you know better, sadder but wiser. Chastened. Let's see what that is. Chastened definition, free online dictionary. Please, I don't need Guinness beer. Okay, try this one. Chastened. And it means obsolete English, chaste, which means you've contained yourself. Castigare, casticus, to correct by punishment and suffering. Corrected by punishment and suffering. So we all have been through the school of hard knocks, and now we know, because we have done wrong, how what it is right to value, what it is right to desire.
Chaste is pure as well.
So yes, purified heart. Mm-hmm. Exactly, refined, subdued, punished. Mm-hmm. All those things. You know, a lot of people know things with their head, but until they've been through the experience, they can't be trusted, because their heart has not been corrected through the pain they have experienced.
You said punished.
Punished and subdued, made to be quieted, refined and purified. Very interesting. To be more humble, the humble heart. That's another one too. Not proud heart, but humble heart in this case. Now all of this sounds like the ABCs. You know, like, but every once in a while you have to remind yourself of the ABCs. Because you can get so caught up in all the fascinating stuff that's in the teaching, that you forget your foundation. So there's a book by Helena Rorick called The Foundations of Tibetan Buddhism. Is that it? It's one of those, it's not an Agni Yoga book, but it's, you know, she wrote it. And it goes back to the life of the Buddha. It's just a wonderful book, reaffirming the foundations on which we are basing our life. I always found that very helpful. Just like I find it helpful to go back and reread Initiation Human and Solar. And I realize, I don't know this. Have I ever read this? And this is that early, small book. You know, amazing. Okay, so the chastened heart, the golden voice, what does that say to us?
Speak kindly.
Yes, speak.
Do no harm.
Exactly, harmless and...
Right speech.
Right speech, yes. And speech through which the soul is expressed. You know what I'm saying? Because it's gold. It's like your golden egoic lotus, which correlates, by the way, with the number 16, the throat center. Okay, 1 and 6 is 7, the throat, form building. You have to speak the soul, speak the golden soul through your voice. So it's a union, in a way, of the heart with the throat center. That is to have the golden voice. The rapid foot, it's not like me where my foot shakes. No, that's not the rapid foot. Something. What is the rapid foot?
With haste, but, you know, keep moving.
Keep moving and purposefully to serve. Come to our aid. The rapid foot. See? That, in other words, do the angels have the rapid foot? See, they do, don't they? Because you invoke the angels to your aid if the cause is right, and there you have it. So that's that instant response, isn't it, to need, the rapid foot. And the open eye which sees the light. The open eye which sees the light. Well, there's only one of those, isn't there? And we talked about it last time, and maybe we'll review. The idea is the third eye opens in the center of the etheric brain through the union of the energies of the Alta, the Crown, and the Ajna. And this, the one begins to see into the inner worlds, and the light in all forms is revealed. You see the light. Actually, when you look at anything, you're seeing light. The Kabbalah tells us that all form is crystallized light. This is light, right here. And we've seen that now, you know, form can be destroyed, and when it is destroyed, atomically it releases this great blaze of light. It is light, and we have to see the world as light. And the inner eye, coming from the conservation of our energies, will reveal the light. So the soul works through the top of the head, down into the center of the etheric brain and into the pineal gland, and then all the energies rise to that point too, if we spend them correctly. So the open eye which sees the light. Another thing too, sometimes the open eye is called the soul itself. The soul itself is the eye which looks out from between the two. That is the soul. So soul vision is needed here. Anyway, these are marvelous rules. They are in Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1, page 583 and 584. And I like to repeat these things to myself once a week, probably, something like that. Just to remind what's important. They are golden rules for the path of spiritual occultism. Any thoughts on this?
Just the way to live your life. I think you can get bogged down with minutiae, and you think you know a lot, but knowledge isn't wisdom, is it?
No, knowledge is not wisdom. Knowledge is not wisdom. There's a beautiful, you know how the third ray is the ray of knowledge in a way, but there is this thing, let the army of the voice responsive to the word cease their activities. Let knowledge end in wisdom. Let the point vibrating become the point quiescent, and in all lines gather into one. Let the soul realize the one in many, and let the word go forth with perfect understanding. I am the worker and the work, the one that is. There are these marvelous, in esoteric psychology too, there are these beautiful seven stanzas. They're just short. But every one of them gives you a picture of soul achievement on one of the rays. And that was the third way, the one I just said. Let knowledge end in wisdom. It's another way of saying, let the knowledge petals of the egoic lotus become the energy of the love petals. See, after the third initiation, what happens to the knowledge petals? Well, they're all open, and interestingly, they begin to, their energy begins to dissipate. Because after the third initiation, what is happening with respect to knowledge? What do you think? It's becoming buddhi, wisdom, intuition. So the buddhic plane is starting to come in, and knowledge per se is transmuted into wisdom following this third degree. Yes?
The color is changing.
The color, yes, the color will be changing. It's all going to move more towards the deeper blue of the buddhic plane. We may remember that the buddhic plane has three colors: yellow, blue, and violet. And that's a study. That's a study in itself. It's yellow for the man, it's blue for the planetary logos, and it's violet for the solar logos. And it just depends on where it fits in the constitution of that particular being. But suffice it to say, more and more people like ourselves should be moving from knowledge into wisdom. But just to show that you do not abandon knowledge, take a look at Master DK. He has not abandoned knowledge, has he? In other words, he's got this incredible amount of knowledge which he wisely shares. That's for us the ideal. So, you know, hopefully every one of us is having the occasion to share our knowledge and wisdom with others to some extent. That's where the service angle comes in. We can always find someone, you know. I remember Mary Bailey, she was the director of the Arcane School, you know, for quite a while after Alice Bailey died. And she said, I don't care who comes to my door, it's maybe the postman, it may be a delivery or whoever, I always drop a seed in. Just one little thing. You never know when it's going to come to fruition. So we do have the responsibility of speaking the ageless wisdom, writing it, speaking it, radiating it, communicating it in some way. And I trust we are all trying to find the way to do that. I hope that's the case. Even with each other, of course. All right, any questions up to this point? We can begin on Rule 7, which are the rules for the astral plane. The thought form has been projected out onto the mental plane, but it has to descend through the different layers before it can be free to go. And you've got to be careful, because if you don't do things right, that form can get reabsorbed into your own energy system and will cause a lot of problems. Can devitalize you, vampirize you, obsess you. You know how it can go. So we have to be very careful in what we do. Okay. The dual forces of the plane, whereon the vital power must be sought, are seen. The two paths face the solar angel. The poles vibrate. A choice confronts the one who meditates. Just before we get into it, what does this say to you? Just, you know, from what you know at present, what does this say to you? What does it suggest to you? Obviously, DK is going to fill it in for us. But it's always good to know what our first impressions are when we read something. I think there's a lot about that in this rule. Very much so. is what you're creating related to the left-hand path of selfishness or the right-hand path of selflessness? That's a big issue. Big issue. And we learned something about the astral plane, don't we? That it is a dual plane, a plane of duality. Have you ever felt in your life the pull of the opposites on the astral plane? I mean, wouldn't you say that for so many thousands of years, that is what we are conscious about? I desire this, I know I shouldn't. I know I should desire that. I desire that, but then somehow I still desire this, you know. And you're pulled in opposite directions, and you are on the battlefield. What's the name of our battlefield in occultism? We have a big, fancy Indian name for it. It begins with a K. Well, the dweller is involved, but let's just say here it is, and you will recognize it immediately, and you will know that you know it. No, that's not it. You've heard of this, Arjuna. You haven't heard of Arjuna? There was in the Atlantean War about 4 million years ago. There is a battlefield, a plain to the south of the city of Delhi, India, where this great battle in Atlantis was fought out, and that's called the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So Arjuna, he was you've heard about him in what is called the Mahabharata. Mahabharata is the great epic of India, one of the great stories. And there was also a movie, a 6 or 7 hour or 9 hour movie made of the Mahabharata by Peter Brook, some English director. This tells the whole story of the conflict between the two sides of the family, representing the Black Lodge and the White Lodge. And here is our disciple, Arjuna. And he sits in his chariot in the middle of the battlefield, seeing the two armies opposing each other, and he cannot decide what he should do, because they are both members of his family. So do you see the analogy to the life of discipleship? Here you are in the middle of your energy system, a battle is about to happen or is happening, and you don't know where you should throw your energy.
What is that thing called?
What is the called?
What is the film called?
The Mahabharata. 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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I hear it's great. And I have only seen snips. You have to kind of sit down for 9 hours and watch it. I don't know. It's a long movie. Long movie. But very, very, very grand and very mythic and very relevant.
Yeah.
So, but our friend Arjuna is lucky, because he has a charioteer, someone driving his chariot, and this charioteer is called Krishna. And Krishna knows what's what. Now, this is not necessarily the Christ, but you know, Krishna is one of those names for a god that go way back. So Krishna says, look, form will always be destroyed. Your inner duty is with the higher light. Throw your forces on the side of those members of your family who represent the higher forces. And then Arjuna does that. He puts his will on the side of that part of the family which represents the soul, and then they win the battle. So you see the analogy to your own life.
Is this something to do with the tarot card, with the white and the black and the chariot?
Well, you know, I can see the link. I can absolutely see the link. There is a card called the Chariot. It is white and black. Mm-hmm. I can really see the link. So good thought on that one.
But one of the interpretations of that card is that you have to go into your own spiritual development.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know, the chariot is obviously, in a way, our vehicles, what we're driving. And the question is, where do we drive it? And how do we direct it? So the story in which this battle of Kurukshetra is narrated is one of the great epics, one of the great classical works which D.K. says should be in the hand of every disciple. You know what this little book is, don't you? It tells the story of, okay, we should know that. It's called the Bhagavad Gita.
Oh, yeah.
Sure, I know you know it. Bhagavad Gita. That tells the story of Arjuna, Krishna, and the battle, and that is everybody's book. D.K. says, what are the books we're supposed to own and know? What are they? Just a few. They're all little. The New Testament. I think he figures we can do without the Old Testament. He tells us the New Testament, yep. At the feet of the Master. That is a good book. It's not one that he mentioned. That's by Alcyone, that's by Krishnamurti. It's a good book. But these are old classics, the ones he mentions. The New Testament, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, all four books, and if the Masters themselves can study book 3 and 4, we can study them too. Then comes the Bhagavad Gita, and finally he offered one other little book, which he had all of his students buy in those early days when he was forming his group. And it was called the Crest Jewel of Discrimination, the Viveka Kudamani. Viveka Kudamani. Just a little book, and who is it written by? A famous sage, the equal of the Buddha. A famous sage who equaled in his development the Buddha. And I know you've heard of him. His name is Shankaracharya. Shankara. Those four books contain the ancient wisdom of India and the wisdom of Christ's new dispensation. He says we should have those and know them. There was a man here who was a doctor. You remember Zaza, some of you.
Yes.
He memorized the Bhagavad Gita in Sanskrit. He was a monk. So that's what monks do. Okay. So he had that book by heart, you know, and then of course he had to come into the world and do other things. But that's really worth reading. And there is, you know, many translations of the Bhagavad Gita. And there is a wonderful translation by the theosophist Sir Edwin Arnold. He wrote two books. It's a poem, long poems. He was an Englishman and an early theosophist. And one of them is called The Light of Asia. And it's a poem, a 100-page poem, about the life of the Buddha. Very beautiful. And the other is the Bhagavad Gita. It's really worth having that. You know, somehow, this morning a little bit, we're talking about some fundamental things. Things that are really things that we stand on. Things that are the basis of our teaching. So these things that I'm reminding us of, they are powerful to give us that sense of being strong in what we're doing. So anyway, we have this choice. We're on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. We are identified with the solar angel. The poles are vibrating. Here is selfishness and materialism and all those good things that the lunar elementals want. And here's the life of the soul. And we have to make a choice. Just like Arjuna made a choice. Now I assume that all of us have made that choice. However, we keep on getting little choices every day to see whether we're really with it. Yes?
To me that also indicates the battle between the personality and soul.
Yes. Yes, exactly. That's it. The personality and its four elemental lives of which the personality is the largest elemental. It's basically the lunar lords and the solar lords. This same theme is repeated over and over in the teaching. For instance, the fifth rule for applicants. Like all of us are like intending to be applicants for some kind of initiation or other, are we not? I mean, you know, even if it's the first initiation, whatever, we have our mind set on the door and the wider life into greater service. So this fifth rule says the following. You are the applicant. You are the applicant to initiation. Let the applicant see to it that the solar angel dims the light of the lunar angels, remaining the sole luminary in the microcosmic sky. It's the same theme. You have the sun in you, you have the moon in you. Let the sun dim the light of the moon so that the sun becomes the only heavenly body, luminary, in your microcosmic consciousness. You are the microcosm. So the same theme is repeated over and again. And even though this theme is very familiar to us, how familiar is it to the average individual who is caught in world problems at this time? These simple things, simple to us, are not known or understood by the people who now have to know and understand them. If people would even get just that little bit, that in themselves there is the higher self and the lower self and the higher self must win, that would make a huge difference in what's going on. We are faced with a humanity today in which we are paying the price of limited consciousness. You look around at where the trouble is, and what is the consciousness behind the actors who are causing the trouble? What kind of consciousness is it? You know, it's emotional, it's lower mental, it doesn't have soul vision, does it? So then what's our responsibility? Obviously. All right, here we go. The battleground of the astral plane. By the way, he tells us that a treatise on white magic, he says, this is what this book is. A treatise on the control of the astral body. That's how he sums up the whole book, A Treatise on White Magic. Yeah.
No, I just thought about what you said before.
Yes.
That we are paying the price for the limited consciousness. But aren't we always doing that? Even we have always been doing that.
If I understand your question.
No, I mean, that will continue.
Sure. But
you said now.
But how degraded, this is my question. Compared to what human consciousness could be, what is it today? Mm-hmm. How degraded is it? So obviously you have all these people fighting to lift human consciousness, and a lot of people under the influence of tamas and rajas, they just want things to be how they are. And so, sure, it will always be that way, but right now we have a crisis. Because it's the time for the soul to emerge, isn't it? So right now, that line between what is personality life and what is soul life, that's becoming very clear. And one of the objectives of the divine plan is to make the line between soul and personality clear so people have a conscious choice about it. Yeah. What did I say that control astral body? Oh, only 105. I think it is the first book ever given out upon the training and control of the astral emotional body. A treatise on white magic. Yeah. Many occult books have been written on the physical body, purification, the etheric body or vital body. Most of them in compilation of other books. This book of mine, however, is intended to train the modern aspirant in the control of his astral body by the aid of the mind, as that mind is in its turn illumined by the soul. That's the purpose of the book. Now, and so obviously a treatise on white magic is not written only for initiates, just like, you know, Cosmic Fire is written only for initiates. But there are parts of white magic which only the initiate will be able to understand. We have a very advanced teaching here. I hope, you know, we realize that. Very advanced. Okay. All right. Where am I? We must start our study and consideration of the seventh rule for magic. We have completed the first six rules, which deal specifically with work on the mental plane, and hence have a practical value only for those who are beginning to utilize the power of the mind in the magical work of creation. How many people in the world do you think are mentally focused? Mentally, in other words, if you could focus physically, emotionally, or mentally as your default position, how many people do you think default to mental focus? What percentage? What percentage?
One for me.
Was it?
No.
Did you say it?
A good guess.
A good guess. And what was the... What?
One for me.
One? You know, I have the feeling it's about 10 to 15% at the most. 10%, somewhere in there. And that's not even mental polarization. Mental polarization is another thing. When is mental polarization achieved? At what point in your development is true mental polarization achieved? This, if you don't know this, this will surprise you. It's somewhere in the initiation process. Right. Between one initiation and another, that's a hint. Between the second and third initiations. So, isn't that interesting? So mental polarization itself is a very high state. But to default to a mental focus and to have a good mentality, that's a different thing. A little, it's lower, but it still represents an achievement. So obviously these rules are for people who are mentally focused.
I think probably then Eric was right, in as much as about one in a million people are mentally polarized.
Well, you know, if you divide that one in a million, of course a million goes into a billion, I suppose, 1,000 times. So.
So that would mean that five people then might have passed the second initiation.
Well, you know, the internet and our modern communication system has done a tremendous amount to raise the level of education. So I think more and more people are becoming minds now. And more people are becoming personalities as well as minds. DK said this would cause its own problems. And we're probably, you know, in a Leo age, you can see how that would be the case. Anyway, your average person cannot pick up these rules. They won't mean anything to them. As a matter of fact, when we read the rules, if we don't study them, they don't mean anything to us either, do they? All this archaic language, you know? Yeah, okay. It is interesting to note in this connection that as humanity enters into its heritage of mind, I want to say that during the very mental Aquarian Age, do I have a right to say that the Aquarian Age is mental? Yeah. Yeah, because what's the principal ray coming through Aquarius? Well, ray 5 comes through Aquarius, and ray 7 accompanies the Aquarian age. So it's 5 and 7. But ray 5 comes through Aquarius, okay? There appears simultaneously a growing tendency towards magical work. So mind and magic go together. Mind and magic. I suppose there are such things as unintelligent magicians. They just repeat what they've heard, and they think something will happen, and it probably will. But that's not an intelligent way of going about it. What about Master R, as Francis Bacon, as Roger Bacon? Was he, is he intelligent? It's an obvious question, isn't it? He's extremely intelligent, and at the same time, the master of magic. I mean, what is magic, really, if you think about it, you know, in a short definition? Of course, you know, magi means great. You know, it's related to maha. It's the great work in some way. Magic is the great work. But what is magic for practical purposes? You know, magicians are always very interesting. They're, you know, they have this thing with the, here's a cloth, and you know there's something behind it, and they lift the cloth and it's gone. What's that all about? Or there's nothing there, and then they lift the cloth and it's there. What's that all about? See? It's all about...
Illusion?
Illusion in a way. By the way, did you see that movie? Anyway, there have been a couple of good movies come out on magic lately about magicians. Very beautiful movies, the names of which I forget, but it's all about appearance and disappearance, isn't it? You change your shape, you appear, you disappear. Those are considered to be magical acts, right? So magic is all about materializing or dematerializing, isn't it? Appearing, disappearing. It's about manifesting or demanifesting. In a way, this whole planet is an act of magic, isn't it? How did it start? Someone had a thought, right?
Yeah,
someone had a thought. There's someone called the planetary logos, in concert with the solar logos. They all sat down together for I don't know how many millions of years and thought it all through, right? So they had an ideal plan, and then what do? They start precipitating it through the various levels until it, voila, appears. That's what magic is about. Making your thought forms appear or disappear. Now, right now, we are in a period of very great building, aren't we? The second ray is the builder, isn't it? Second ray and seventh ray together, the building rays. What are we trying to do? We want a new world, right?
So, create a new world.
Create a new world. A new pattern has to appear. The old pattern has to go, right?
So that we're true sorcerer's apprentices, really, aren't we?
We are, and the sorcerer better not leave us alone with the magic words. Ever see that Walt Disney with all the brooms multiplying before you know it, all the brooms are carrying the water?
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
And then the sorcerer comes home and says, okay.
But I think you see things. You see the film, The Avatar.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there are people thinking new thoughts, or
yes,
old thoughts.
Old thoughts and new forms, you know, yes. Nothing new under the sun. Absolutely. We're trying to remake our world in a seventh ray age of great mental focus. So this is the seventh time in the Aryan age in which the seventh ray has accompanied an age of Aquarius. The seventh time, we are told.
That's the last one.
Well, this is a very promising period. Very promising. and we're involved in this, and we have 2,000 years of it. The technical duration of an age, a processional age, is 2,160 years. Okay. If you double that, you get the famous 432. Okay. So we have 2,000 or so years to make this happen. But something even more encouraging is going on. We have a 25,000 year age of Aquarius beginning. 25,000 years. That's a long time. That means that every one of those lesser ages that we're going to go through, you know, Aquarius, Capricorn, Sagittarius, Scorpio, blah, 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 they're all ruled by Aquarius for the next 25,000 years. And the question is, will the seventh ray also accompany that huge cycle? I don't know. You know, DK doesn't give that. But obviously, a ray accompanies the big age as well as the little age. So we have the little age of 2,000 years. What have you been doing in the last 2,000 years? How many times have you shown up here?
Wow.
Only once.
Is there a chart somewhere that tells you how many times somebody's
incoming? DK called out Leadbeater and he said, look, you know, don't pay attention to these cycles given to you by the theosophists, 100 in, 100 out, you know, like that. He says, you cannot predict such things. You don't know the cycles, and all of that is erroneous. But we can be sure. 2,000 years is a long time, isn't it? Think back 2,000 years. How many life cycles is that? Several, at least? Maybe 10, even? Maybe during the last 2,000 years, we have been here in various places, various times. 2,000 years is a very long time in terms of life cycles, isn't it? Now just think about 25,000. So we have some time now to get things straight during even this little age of Aquarius. And right now we are in that very uncomfortable transition time.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to see that even people working with history, not with astrology, but with history.
Yes, yes.
They now agree that the time started much before they really can prove it. So recently they have found signs from old people. They believe they were born 2,000 years before our age. So that means 4,000 years.
Yes, exactly.
They have found signs in Austria just recently.
Yes.
Where they have moved the history back.
It's going to be moved back and back and back. We have such myopic vision of history. You know, it was just like 8,000 years or something, 5,000, 8,000 years. It's just minuscule compared to what has been. That's why The Secret Doctrine is such a great book. When you pick up The Secret Doctrine, you get this incredible vision of what the history of our planet has been, how long it has taken. Now, when you have those kind of thoughts in your mind, you can't do the crazy things that people are doing all over the world right now because they believe in only their God, only their prophet, only their Savior, this heaven, this earth, that's it. You know, it's so, you know, like almost infantile is what it is. But they'll kill you if you say so. But that distinction will be ours over the next number of years, because during these years, it will be necessary to stand up and say things when people are in a panic about their own salvation. You know what I mean? I mean, the astral body, the fear of the astral body grips them. Now, does anybody remember, did we read the section on fear last time?
We did.
You know, about the different kinds of meditations that you can do to ward off fear and so forth.
But I think he's saying this is a typical sign. At this age, you would say, what is this age? But you say that. I think it was in the Gemini section in esoteric astrology. There you have all five different definitions about the crisis we have for the moment, where fear is the first one.
Fear is the first,
and actually, the fear is the battle between your personality and your soul.
Yes. We're in the middle of it right now. So you know what they say, you know, the strong hand in the dark. You have to be the strong hand in the dark to a lot of people whose consciousness just isn't there yet.
And the strong hand used to be the church, but of course that's crumbling now as well.
It really is.
Coming out of the woodwork, all this disgusting stuff. And people are saying, well, where else do I look?
Exactly, exactly.
I have nowhere else to look.
So that's where our responsibility really comes in. Even in our own little ways, in our own little circle, we have the responsibility. And, you know, not everybody is going to be happy when we execute that responsibility. They'll want to execute us. But okay, that's always the price of truth, I guess, over the many years. So anyway, humanity enters into its heritage of mind during an age ruled by the third ray, the seventh ray, the fifth ray. And there appears this tendency to magical work. And he says the schools of affirmation are cropping up on all sides, which is really a seventh ray thing. You know, you affirm it until you get it, you know. Affirm and receive. And obviously a lot of it is very selfish. I want this car, I want this house, I visualize it, I affirm it. You know, what are you going to do? It's not service, it's what I want. It's all in the service of the astral body, whose announced intent is to create those natural conditions where man may be able, may have what he deems to be admirable and advisable. Books on the subject of the creative mind are flooding the markets, and discussions of the force back of the creative arts are deemed of vital interest. Psychology, and this was even, you know, when did he write this? 70, 80 years ago. Psychologists are giving the entire matter much consideration. And though at present the ideal is viewed almost entirely in terms of the physical plane, yet the sum total indicates a vibratory activity in the world of soul. Okay, so all of this awakening to the power of inner magic, even though it's a little selfish, does say that we as souls are waking up, right? Okay. As it expresses itself through humanity and issues forth from the mental realm. So, this should be the word from. The pioneers of the race and the foremost thinkers and creative workers of humanity are but the sensitives who respond most readily to the mental impulses. Can we number ourselves among those people? I hope so. We're not just responding only to emotional impulses, what feels good, what doesn't. I mean, you know, that's what the demagogue does. The demagogue stands in front of his country and plays on the astral body of the nationals of that country. He's not speaking to the thinking person. How does it feel? Do you want that? Do you want this? So, and that's where a lot of decisions are being made, right at that level. Okay. They are in the minority as yet, these sensitives, and most people respond to the forces and vibrations emanating from the plane of emotions and desire. Now that's most everybody. If you're going to get any place with most people, you have to offer them what they find attractive. Not what they find thoughtful or clear, but whether they like it or they don't like it. Have you noticed that? Have you even noticed that with your relatives? Especially with your relatives, perhaps. All right. More and more, however, our awakening and the significance of the six first rules of magic will become increasingly apparent. Okay? So then he tells us the 15 rules are divided, 6 for the mental plane, 5 for the astral plane, 4 for the physical plane. You know, and I really wonder why those numbers? You know, it's kind of interesting because in a way there are 4 ethers on the physical plane. There are 5 subplanes of the astral plane which we are to use. We're not supposed to use subplane number what and what on the astral plane.
6 and 7.
6 and 7, we're not supposed to use those. Matter of fact, he tells us on plane number 7, subplane number 7, what can you find there? If you're a good Christian, what can you find on subplane number 7? Hell. That's what you can find on subplane number 7. You can find hell. And it sounds like subplane number 6 is not much better. And then we have the 6 rules on the mental plane, and I wonder if those, if the 6 subplanes involved are not somehow everything from the second subplane on down. Where is our soul located if we are aspiring people? Well, yeah, and not only now, it is specific. Okay, you are correct in that. But now it is specific, and I'll show you what I mean, and you know this. So we're just checking up on what we know, you know, little pressure testing. Okay, so right here. Okay. Right here. Our egoic lotus is on subplane 2. If what? Where is it for the average person? Is it there? No. Average person, where is it? There.
Is it four?
No. Because the egoic lotus never goes below the third subplane. So for the average person, their soul is still focused materially on this third subplane. But if we become what's called advanced humanity, and we approach the first initiation or take it, the egoic lotus changes its frequency, and therefore is able to focus or sustain its position on subplane number 2. So I'm wondering if the 6 rules for the mental plane don't basically go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Because once you get to the very highest level of the mental plane, you're in another category altogether. Then it's no longer about the solar angel, it's about the spiritual triad. So the spiritual triad begins with the abstract mind on the very highest level of the mental plane. Let's just say that if you enter the spiritual triad, let me give you 3 words. Personal, individual, impersonal. Personal, individual, impersonal. This is the personal world. It correlates with the tarot card number 18. It is the moon. 18 subplanes. Personal world. Individual world correlates with the world of the egoic lotus on subplanes 2 and 3. Impersonal world correlates with the spiritual triad, beyond our personal individual identity. Spiritual triad. Do you ever get the sense that you are living in a way that is responsive to the spiritual triad? Or how would you know? How would we know?
Impulse.
If?
Through the impulse, through invocation.
Yes, something would come over us, something would come through us, and it wouldn't be about what we've done in our last 1,000 lives. It wouldn't be about that. Mm. It wouldn't be about us at all. Mm. It wouldn't be about little us as a personality. It wouldn't be about our endless cycles when we were this, that, and the other. It would come from above. Mm. And it would be about the life of the big being in whom we live and move and have our being. Yes?
Yes, you said something about 18 steps.
Subplanes, yes. Yes.
And I was in a course with Martinus, the philosopher, the Danish philosopher. And we learned that if we should change anything in our system, we have to go 18 steps down.
18 steps?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Let the 18, let the group see that all the 18 fires die down. That is rule number 4, and we've got number 18 to deal with. And 18 is a lunar number. Now, I think that's one of the best, you know, shows how the tarot and this kind of wisdom all fits together, that the moon card is card 18. Now, interestingly enough, the sun card is card 19. And you just step above the line there, and you're now into the higher mind with number 19. So, in other words, we have 3 types of lives we can live. I can put it in different ways. Personal, transpersonal, transcendental. personal, transpersonal, transcendental. Another way is to look at it: personal, individual, impersonal. But you get what I'm saying. If we rise up into the spiritual triad, we forget ourselves, even our soul. We forget our egoic nature too. It's all sacrifice. We say, okay, this is the life of God. I am a tiny little unit in the life of God. The will of God is what counts. The greater love of God is what counts. And the mind, planetary mind of God, that's what counts. That's a different angle on things, isn't it? Yes. The sun will shine, you know. Just maybe we should have a moment of meditation where we visualize a very full cup of black coffee in the center of the room, conveying to us whatever we need to stay awake. Okay.
Sorry, but personal in the third one was the third one.
Well, okay. Personal,
yeah.
Individual, impersonal.
Impersonal.
You know what's so interesting when you study with the Arcane School? How many of us have studied with the Arcane School, right? Okay. So they always tell you, okay, impersonality. You got to be impersonal. But so often, it's a personal interpretation of impersonality. It's something like something that happens to the personality and it becomes impersonal. But the truly impersonal life is a much different thing. You have even left your well-nurtured individuality of the higher mental plane behind. And the truly impersonal life doesn't begin until after the third initiation, and not even truly until the fourth initiation, the truly impersonal life. And you know, people say, well, if I'm going to be impersonal, look how much I'm going to lose. All the things that make life worth living, I'm going to lose them. But in fact, the gain of the impersonal life is incredible. It is really, you know, like when Christ looks at us, he says, you know, poor ones. That's what he says. Doesn't make any difference how much money you have, what kind of, where you live, whatever. Poor ones, that's who we are. Because we don't have the impersonal life. So when we build the Antikarana, that's on the way to the impersonal life, isn't it? Exactly. Okay. All right. I know that you need a break. It won't be long now. So we have 6, 5, and 4 rules. The main thought to be held clearly in mind is that they confine themselves to the use of energy in the three worlds, and that this energy is either consciously manipulated by the governing soul or is swept into activity by the force inherent in the matter of the three worlds. The devas of the lower four feel the force when the eye opens. They are driven forth and lose their master. That's the sixth rule, isn't it? Meaning, we're no longer controlled by this big personality elemental. We are controlled by these higher energies manipulated by the governing soul. We become a soul-infused personality. We've talked about it forever, but to actually be that is another matter. Okay, so you've got two ways to go here. You either go with sin, Satan, and the devil, or with the soul. What is the devil, philosophically? In the way it says here, doesn't it? The forces of matter. Okay, here's the devil. There was a solar system previous to ours. And now, the dense physical body of our solar logos is consisting of the matter and energies of that earlier solar system. That's the devil. 666. That's the devil. Because 6 is the number of form, and if you get right down here into these lower 18,
of course that's 18, not 18.
This is 18 again.
Six,
the devil, exactly 18.
18.
There it is.
No.
The devil. Okay. The devil is 18. The moon, horns, two horns of the moon.
Yeah.
And here's the whole point. Our solar logos doesn't even treat these lower 18 as if it's important. It's just his dense physical body. And the devil hangs out in the dense physical body of the solar logos. That's where. Or even of the planetary logos, let's just say. Because believe it or not, the dense physical body of the solar logos even includes 21. But for the planetary logos, it's 18. In other words, our soul nature is still part of the dense physical body of the solar logos. So in other words, as I've often said, we're not even alive until we can get to this point here, the Buddhic plane. That's where we really begin to breathe and be alive. Interestingly enough, it's the plane of air. It's the airplane. Airplane, the Buddhic plane, the plane of air. And we're not even breathing life until we reach the Buddhic plane. Now most of us, in that way, we're all living underwater right now. Matter is water, water is matter, and we're living underwater right now. Yes?
I thought about the number six.
Yes.
And the relation to Neptune.
Yes.
And Varuna, but also the church.
Yes.
And what's going on, you know, yes. In the Vatican and the Pope. And
yeah, yeah.
I think they are drowning.
They're drowning, but you know what?
The church is very sixth ray, isn't it?
That's yes.
Devotional.
Yeah, very much so. It has a six-ray astral body and a six-ray mind, the church does, says the Tibetan. But he says, look, the signs of the Christ. Achieve peace, a measure of it. Start to share, a measure of it. And let the church clean house.
Mm.
Oh. Okay, we're on target.
Yeah.
The church is cleaning house.
Yes.
And, you know, it's not liking what it finds under the rug.
But in a way you can say that's happening all over the world with all the earthquakes and the water.
Wait till we get with the moon in Pisces. I mean Neptune in Pisces. This is only a foretaste of that. The waters will flow. As a matter of fact, the effects of global warming on the rising of the oceans, I would say we're going to see indications of that when Neptune comes into Pisces. I think it's going to be a time of many tears. This is my
anticipation.
Tears. Exactly. And Pisces rules the tear glands in the eye. You know how Pisces people, they oftentimes have watery eyes? Have you noticed that? Yeah, they do. Not always, but you know, it depends on all the other modifications, but sometimes you see those luminous, watery eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're all heading into it, you know, and it's just a question of being sort of as strong in the teaching as we can be, because you know, when the wind blows and the floods come and all the rest of it, how are you going to stand? You know, when these times come? How stand? Or will we just be swept away?
See. We have to move to a higher level.
Well, that too, you know what I thought was very interesting? I back in 1887, there was a volcano called Krakatoa.
Yeah.
And it makes this, I can't pronounce the Icelandic word, but it makes that volcano look very small. Mm-hmm. So Krakatoa was like 3 years of volcanic pollution all over the world. And lowering of the degrees of summer and all the rest of it. But I saw a documentary about Krakatoa, and it was it around Sumatra, or it was one of the Dutch possessions down in that part of the world, belonging to Holland, Netherlands. And it was a story about some people knew what was coming. And I was remembering a native person, quite educated, taking the governor of that Dutch protectorate and strapping him to a tree. Mm. Say, take your belt, tie it around you. You know, everything had to be done quick, quick, quick. So these trees, they were strapped to the trees, and then came the waters from the tidal wave, from the tsunami. And it swept everything aside, everything was destroyed, and these two guys, they were strapped to the tree, and they survived that.
Mm.
And when the waters receded, they were able to continue climbing to higher ground. Well, there were dangers in higher ground too. Then when the volcano finally blew its top, this wave of superheated air,
pyroclastic flow.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yep.
With dust in it.
It flowed even to the high ground, and it boiled everything. Mm. If you were outside, you were finished. Mm-hmm. So, but even on the low ground was the water, on the high ground was the superheated air, fire and air together. But they survived somehow. This amazing thing. There was also a famous captain who had a ship full of people in the middle of the tidal wave, and he knew just what to do. He knew where to put the people in the boat so it wouldn't tip over, and the boat was like climbing up this thing, just like this, to get over the top. It was an absolute miracle that they survived. So yes, the elements are telling us something right now.
Is
Krakatoa also, is it?
It's getting bigger. So.
You mean it's emerging again?
Yes.
Look, the Manu is busy. The Manu's department controls volcanoes.
Yes.
You know that.
When did this happen? 1887. Film about Krakatoa, not the Hollywood.
Maybe we saw the same one. I don't know. It could have been the same one.
Very good.
It really. When you're dealing with these forces of nature, these elemental forces under the control of the Manu, you really see what elemental power can be. And obviously, the Manu. You know, we're getting ready for a change of race here. We're getting ready for a reshaping of the Earth. The Manu is very busy. And we say, oh, natural disaster, terrible, look what it's doing to humanity. But we haven't got the slightest idea what the Manu has in mind. All under the direction of the planetary logos. And so look, you know, when the waters come, this is my point, are you going to be strapped to the tree of the ageless wisdom? That's what I'm saying. Because somehow you have not to blow away or be swept away. You have to be able to have your anchor, so that the others who are just, you know, in the waters can be rightly oriented. It is coming, there's no question. Let's just say that everything that was wrong with the earlier solar system is now coming to a head in this solar system. That's what the battle is all about right now. The materialistic tendencies of the previous solar system are now coming to a head at this time in our history, and that's what the reappearance of the Christ is all about too. It's saying, okay folks, let's shift the balance to the second ray now. The soul ray of our planet and the soul ray of the solar logos. It's second ray time now, and this is the transition between those two rays. And we happen to live in interesting times, as the Chinese say.
For good reason.
Well, and hopefully we can do something about it and help. Yes.
But it must also be part of the Earth's initiation.
Exactly. The Earth, whether it is the chain, whether it is the chain lord or the planetary logos himself, a fourth initiation is being taken in our chain on our globe. Now that is not a comfortable initiation, is it?
No.
So the eruption of all the lower forces is accompanied by the steadfast will of those who know. Vulcan, the steadfast will, powerful at the fourth initiation. So do we need spiritual will? Do we need an anchor? Do we need to stand in spiritual being? Know where we stand. See, in other words, up till now we've been doing a lot of learning. Learning. Okay. Now the will is going to be called for so that we will stand as needed in this very very stressful time ahead. Look, it almost always begins with economics.
Mm.
Look at World War II.
Mm.
What preceded World War II?
Yeah.
A Great Depression.
Yeah.
In Germany, across the world, in the Western countries, a Great Depression. Mm-hmm. What did it lead to? Radical thought.
Mm-hmm.
Radical social solutions, right? And you can always find economics and war going together. Now hopefully we have the kind of world today where people are more in touch, they're smarter and so forth, but the changes that are about to occur are so huge that, as the Tibetan said, we know what's going to happen, but we can't say. And he said that, it slipped my mind what he said, but basically that humanity would realize that it could not solve its own problems by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the hierarchy would be invoked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
But the relation between Venus and the Earth,
yes,
in a way, both waiting for us to do this thing.
Yes, yes.
But in a way, it must be able to help us.
Absolutely. I would say there's a triangle here between Venus, Vulcan, and the Earth. It's a and remember, somewhere he said, the Earth has a special relationship to Taurus. It's not a ruling planet, but it's specially related to Taurus. So think of it. Earth has a special relationship, Venus ruling Taurus, Vulcan ruling Taurus. It's all about having enough spiritual will, Vulcan, to bring the great light of Venus into manifestation on the Earth. See, all of us have this in our energy system too, don't we? Look, Vulcan, Venus, the Earth, right there in the head, above the torso.
Is that what they mean about going through the eye of the bull?
Through
the mind of God.
Through the mean, yes,
is
yes.
There something to do with transcending?
Two kinds of things, going into the eye of the bull and going through the eye of the needle. They are both involving Venus and Vulcan on a lower turn of the spiral.
Yes.
Obviously, the eye of the bull, what's the star who is the eye of the bull?
Alcyone.
Is it called?
Alcyone.
Alcyone is very important as the center of the Pleiades. But Alcyone is much farther away, but the eye of the bull is closer, about 60 or 70 light years. It's called, it also begins with an A. It begins with the name A-L. Al, it's Al. Al. Okay, Aldebaran. Aldebaran, St. Michael and his armies, Aldebaran and all the rest of it. That's the eye of the bull. This very powerful star, 5,000 times brighter than our sun, is closer than Alcyone and closer than the Pleiades, and that is the eye of the bull. So Venus and Vulcan and the Earth are all involved in this triangle. And so are we as human beings, aren't we? Do we have the spiritual will, monad, to bring our soul, Venus, into manifestation in our personality, the Earth? Do we have that? And if we can do that, then society can do that too. Okay. Alright, well I think it's 11 exactly.
When we talk about,
yes,
Venus,
yes,
and Taurus, it's also a question about resources.
Yes.
In many different ways, because,
yes,
you say in Taurus is money.
Yes,
but
and
so it's
Venus too.
So lift it up to a higher level and look at resources.
Absolutely.
From another perspective.
Yes, and the sharing of resources, because if we were really functioning under Venus, which is the love wisdom of the soul, how would we be treating resources on this planet?
Sharing.
See, we wouldn't be.
We'd be sharing.
Yeah, exactly. It's not about greed, is it?
No.
Venus is not about greed. Of course, you know, lower Venus, luxury and all the rest of it. But the kind of Venus we want to respond to is about harmony, sharing, distribution, and so forth. Mm. Now, think of it.
It's the purse of gold, isn't it?
Yes.
Really, when they're talking in the first rules of the road.
Venus is the purse of gold.
Gold, which you share.
Which he scatters not upon the road, but shares with others.
Mm.
Venus is that, absolutely. Now, look at the decanates of Aquarius. The disciple goes through the decanates. The first one is ruled by what planet? When the disciple enters Aquarius. with Aquarius, I'm getting there, of course. The disciple enters via Saturn. Difficulty. Then comes Mercury, then comes Venus. But turn it around. And average humanity enters via Venus in Aquarius. 720 years of Venus in Aquarius. So the possibility of learning the meaning of sharing comes to humanity as a whole. And it's the disciples of the world, Saturn, who have to teach that difficult lesson. So, you know, it all makes sense, and the situation that we're in right now is predictable. How it will turn out is in humanity's hands. In other words, the time equation. DK said in one place, if delay comes, because the disciples of the world don't do what they're supposed to, it probably won't last more than 300 years. I mean, what's 300 years? It seems like a lot when we look at our normal lifespan, but they see it coming. It's in the, you know, and I would say that the next 15 years will determine whether we have to go through those 300 years or not. So I would say in the last part of the period of the forerunner, these 15 years from 2010 to 2025, this determines which way humanity goes. Back into a delayed departure of the sixth ray and all of its, you know, reactionary ways, or into the new age of Aquarius. Now, actually, I have faith in the cycles. I do. When DK says that in the 21st century, the Piscean influence will completely disappear, and then he predicts that the sixth ray will be out of incarnation by the year 2130, I say, this is pretty good. So I would say the next 15 years will decide whether during the next 100 years we have to really suffer, or whether we can be much more intelligent about it and make the transition without those wrenching changes which subject everybody to great pain. Well, perhaps on that cheerful note, we should take a little break.
Thank you.
We have been here 1 hour and a half, and now I would suggest if you can get yourself out of your chair, you just head there for a little revival, and I'll see you back in 15 minutes. Okay.
I talked to Andreas.
Okay, yes.
He has the LC.